This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Have you voted yet? Early elections and early voting is underway in North Carolina. Election day, exactly 2 weeks from today. But early voting, as I said, is underway in North Carolina. So when you cast your ballot, you're choosing between candidates with different philosophies, of course, ideologies, even personal style. But here's one thing. Mitt Romney and Barack Obama want you to know that they are both committed to the American dream.
Every great innovation, every world-changing business breakthrough begins with a dream. And nothing is more fragile than a dream. The genius of America is that we nurture those dreams.
You know, the bedrock of our economic success is the American dream. It's a dream shared in big cities and small towns across races, regions, and religions.
So what is the American dream? Is it a company job with benefits, a company job without benefits? Is it owning a home or free education that gives your kids the opportunity to go to college? Maybe there are as many American dreams as there are Americans. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hedrick Smith believes there was a clear and agreed-on American dream once. It included shared prosperity. His new book is called Who Stole the American Dream? Hedrick Smith reads tonight at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, and he's my guest on the program today. Hedrick Smith, good to have you here.
Good to be with you, Frank.
Tell us about this book. You take a historical view, and you sort of look at how this dream has been understood through the years. And so take us back to Henry Ford. We start with him.
Well, let me just take you back to my own beginnings, because I started working on this book about 3 years ago in the fall of 2009. At that point, it was pretty clear the American dream was in a lot of trouble. People getting laid off. We've almost forgotten it. 600,000-700,000 people every month were losing their jobs. And hundreds of thousands later, millions were being forced out of their homes, foreclosed. People didn't know if they were going to have enough money to get through the recession, save for their retirement, take care of their kids' education. So American dream was clearly in trouble. And I actually began with a bunch of questions. I really didn't have an answer. The book that I've written, Who Stole the American Dream, is actually not the book I started out to write. I started out to write a book called The Dream at Risk. I mean, I knew it was in trouble, but how do we go from an era of middle-class prosperity and power, which it was in America in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and functioning effective bipartisanship in our politics, to an era of today of partisan gridlock, starkly unequal democracy, gaping inequalities in our economy, and a middle class clearly stuck in a rut. I mean, what happened in between? What were the changes that took place in our economic system, in our political system? Now, you mentioned Henry Ford, which is as good a place to start, I guess, as any, because over a century ago, Ford had the idea that if he paid his workers more, they could afford to buy the products he was producing. If he paid his automobile workers a $5 day, which at that point was an unheard of amount of money for a single day's work, they could afford to buy the Model T cars that Ford was turning out. That idea, and there were lots of bumps in the road, and there were other things Henry Ford that did that weren't so admirable, but nonetheless, that idea got carried forward into this era of shared prosperity after World War II, 3 decades anyway, where other CEOs, Charlie Wilson at General Motors, Frank Abrams at Standard Oil in New Jersey, Reg Jones at General Electric, and lots of others, including the professors in the business schools, said it was the job of the CEO. Listen to this. It was the job of the CEO to share prosperity. They practiced what they called stakeholder capitalism. All the groups that had a stake in the success of the company, the shareholders, the owners, of course, but managers, employees, suppliers, creditors, customers, the communities they operated in, they all had a stake in the company, and the CEO felt it was his job, and you can read the quotes in my book and you can read the rest of them in the library. These guys actually said, it's my job to balance these interests, not just to take care of the shareholders, which is now the mantra in American capitalism. It is boost the stock price, take care of Wall Street, and take care of the shareholders, and let the rest just fend for themselves.
And there was an understanding that shareholder value was tied to this particular market, because after all, this is one of the wealthiest markets. So if you're selling cars, for instance, you better make sure you have car buyers in the United States of America who can afford them.
But that seems such an obvious truth as we talk about it historically. But it's not an obvious truth today. We'll flash forward to today if you want, but at least recognize that one of the things people have been doing in American business for the last 30 years is holding wages down. There's been the pressure of international competition and globalization. There's been a very tough employer attitude. CEOs have taken more and more of the share of the profits for themselves and their owners and the shareholders, and particularly for Wall Street. And the result is that we don't have a middle class today that's got a lot of spending power. There's a lot of talk today about the job creators, as if the job creators were at the top of the American economy, that you need to have the wealthy have low taxes so they could save up a lot of capital to invest in business. That isn't the problem in the American economy today. There was a story in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago which said that venture capital funds had accumulated $1 trillion of money to invest in American business, and they couldn't find any good businesses to invest in, so they were thinking of giving the money back to their investors. So capital wasn't the problem. The problem was exactly what we were talking about before. Henry Ford, the virtuous circle of growth. Pay your workers well. They go out and spend money. Consumer demand drives the next round of production. Companies have to build new plants, buy equipment, hire more workers. That was called the virtuous circle of growth. That lay at the heart of America's prosperity and shared prosperity.
And let's take a look at what America looked like. Let's go back to something called the Treaty of Detroit, 1948, when this kind of leverage that workers had against against the corporation, against the company, met a different standard, of a higher standard of living. But what's the Treaty of Detroit, and how did that change?
The Treaty of Detroit was the anchor, in many ways, the anchor of the middle class standard of living for three decades. It was signed in 1948 between General Motors and the United Auto Workers Union, hence Detroit, the auto industry, right? Treaty of Detroit. Why was it called a treaty? Because General Motors wanted the end of wildcat strikes that were disrupting production. Charlie Wilson, the head of General Motors, said, I want to get on with making cars. We can make cars, we can sell them, we can make a profit and make the business boom. And Walter Reuther, the head of the UAW, said, fine, we'll help you do that. But in return for that, we want steady jobs, rising wages, we want health benefits, we want a pension. And that was, by the way, the first time there was a pension plan adopted by a major American corporation. And that became the model. They talked about copycat contracts in other places, Ford, Chrysler, United Steelworkers, the rubber industry in Akron, Ohio, atomic industry, electrical industry. People copied that. In fact, many non-union companies adopted those same standards. General Motors was the model for everybody, that contract, the Treaty of Detroit. And it sustained and supported, it became the underpinning of a good middle class standard of living and shared prosperity. So when people think about that era, they think of the American dream in terms of that labor agreement, steady job, rising income, health benefit, retirement benefit, enough money so you could begin to put a down payment down and pay your mortgage on your home. So by the time you retired, 30 years later, you could pay off your home and you could have a secure retirement. And you'd hope that you could finance some kind of better education for your kids. That was the dream. And, you know, people forget it. 6 out of 7 workers in any company, unionized or otherwise, in America that had more than 100 workers, they got a fully paid pension. 70% of the workers got fully paid employer health insurance. Those numbers have dropped dramatically today. There are only 30% that get the pension, and there are only about 18% that get fully paid health benefits. So that was a radically different time in terms of the underpinnings of and the buttressing of a middle-class standard of living, which became the driving force. The consumer demand became the driving force for the whole economy. It wasn't just the middle class that benefited, but it was the whole economy that benefited.
We will talk about how that changed and what impact it's had when our conversation continues with Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who spent decades as a correspondent for the New York Times. New book called Who Stole the American Dream? Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, correspondent for the New York Times for many years. He's got a new book out called Who Stole the American Dream? And just before the break, you were talking about a time when the American middle class really grew. And so in terms of, you know, you talked about having pensions. What percentage of American workers had a pension? What percentage had paid health benefits? What about the disparity between the CEOs and workers?
Very interesting. Economists call that the period of the Great Convergence. And what they mean by the Great Convergence is the people at the top their pay and their income was not so far from the people in the middle, and the people in the middle were not so far from the people at the bottom. The convergence. Today we have the great divergence, the great inequality. Then it was so much more equal at that time. And there was inequality. Don't misunderstand me. A CEO made maybe 40 times what the average assembly line worker made for a company like General Motors. Today it's close to 400, 360 times. So it's 9 times greater. So that tells you there's been a tremendous change. The pay and the income standards were so close then compared to now that Richard Nixon, when he was vice president, could go in 1959 to Moscow and have a debate with Nikita Khrushchev, who was then head of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. And Khrushchev could say to Nixon, we're going to build a classless society. And Nixon could turn around and put his finger in Khrushchev's eye and say, we have a classless society. Now, that's overdoing it. Nixon was understandably boasting about America, fighting the communists and so forth. But nonetheless, it was close enough to the truth that people accepted it. Now, I mean, the thing that people forget, and I have to say I forgot it. It was only in doing the research for this book that I really got into it. That middle-class prosperity depended in a great sense on middle-class power. We mentioned the trade unions. We mentioned the power of the United Auto Workers with being able to bargain kind of on a toe-to-toe basis with General Motors or General Electric and the other big corporations, U.S. Steel and so forth. And then there was the consumer movement led by Ralph Nader, pushing for better standards, more honesty in labeling, better quality products, cut the defective cars. I mean, Nader said GM and Ford and the others were producing cars that were defective and they were causing accidents and people were getting wounded or killed. Then there was the civil rights movement. Blacks protesting, widening the American dream. We want the jobs. We want access to the buses, to the lunch counters, to the hotels, to the whole public accommodations. We want equal voting rights. So that was another movement where protest came from the belly of the land. The environmental movement, enormous. People have forgotten today the idea of civic activism is almost astonishing to people. 20 million people on Earth Day 1970 went out into the streets, went out into the parks, into the shopping centers, to universities, and engaged in talk-ins and sit-ins and protests and said, we are no longer going to tolerate the fouling of the nation's waters, the fouling of the nation's air. We don't want any more smog over L.A. that's actually causing asthma patients to die. We don't want the Cuyahoga River so jammed with chemicals that it actually bursts into flame. We don't want this algae that coats the Potomac River in Washington and you bring your arm out with slime. We want change.
And as you point out in your book, and as we all know, it brought change. I mean, it wasn't just going out, a lot of middle-class Americans protesting. There was then Richard Nixon, who was essentially forced to design and create an environmental protection agency.
No question. About it. What's interesting, Frank, is that people in that era believed that popular action could achieve governmental action. They believed the people had power. They believed in people power. And as you point out, Nixon, no tree-hugging environmentalist, created the Environmental Protection Agency. Congress passed the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Anti-Toxic Substance Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, and a slew of other environmental legislation. The civil rights laws were passed. All the stuff that Nader was pushing for. All that was in response to public pressures, to public activism, to people literally marching in the streets. I remember talking to Bill Ruckelshaus, who was the first head of the EPA under Richard Nixon. And we were talking about that. And he said, you know, when he would go meet with Nixon in the White House, he had a hard time getting Nixon interested. He said Nixon didn't care about the environment, but he said he had to do something. And as Ruckelshaus put it to me, that's the way democracy is supposed to work. So when we think about that era of prosperity and shared prosperity in particular, and the middle class having its heyday, we have to remember that the middle class was very active in demanding and pushing for that and getting it, both from the corporate leadership and the political leadership.
And something you point out, and I think it's very important to talk about right here, shared prosperity didn't mean having a job. Shared prosperity meant sharing in the productivity gains that corporations had enjoyed over that period of time, because at that period, productivity gains for the corporation and wage gains for the worker were pretty much in lockstep.
It's amazing. It's amazing to see the difference. There is a dividing line in American history that sits right about 1973, 74, 75. Prior to that, for the previous 30 years, as you point out, the productivity of the American workforce roughly doubled, 97% gain. And the wages of and salaries of average Americans, not just factory workers, but middle-class Americans, rose 95%, almost identical. From 1970, that's when the wedge comes in. I call it wedge economics, comes in about the mid-70s. And from 1973 to 2011, the last year for which we have data, the productivity gain was 80% and the wage gain and the total compensation gain, including benefits, was 10%. So you're getting a 10% gain, and actually the Census Bureau says that that from 1978 to 2011, the average hourly pay of a male worker was identical, adjusted for inflation. Three decades of going nowhere. At the same time, CEO pay went up over 300% at the major corporations, and the pay to the people in the top 1%, the super, super, super rich, went up 600%. So you have this flat, no gains from productivity, and then this enormous gain up at the top. That's where the wedge comes in. And it isn't just a matter of life change, globalization came, technology changed. It's how we divvied up the pie. The pie kept growing, but the slice of the middle class got no bigger, and all the gains were going to the other folks as the pie got larger.
So these days, when everybody talks about jobs, 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 let's create jobs, they're creating jobs that inevitably favor the core. For everybody I hire, every time I put you on, I'm getting a whole lot in return for your work that you're not going to enjoy. Well, some job is that. What kind of job is that?
Well, and a lot of them. As a matter of fact, I follow a bunch of people that have lost their jobs, people who had solid middle-class jobs. And this is a familiar story, but people like Pam Scholl and Mike Hughes out in Circleville, Ohio, and they had good jobs at the RCA tube plant, and then they lost the jobs when the plant shut down in 2005. They bounced around. This is before the recession, by the way. The plant closed down. 59,000 plants closed in America, all across America, in that decade between 2000 and 2010. And they bounced around, and Mike Hughes is now – he was a technical supervisor making about $60,000 a year. He's now a night custodian at a local high school making, I don't know, $13,000, $14,000, $15,000 a year, and he's got another job making another three. So he's dropped out of the middle class. There are a lot of middle class dropouts now. And Pam Scholl was unemployed for 18 months, went through absolute misery, wondered if her life was worthwhile. She's now got a job with the local sheriff's office, and she's making about a half or 40% of the pay she made before. And very happy to have a job, but not the same standard of living. So you're right. I mean, even when their new jobs generated, for an awful lot of people, they represent a step down, not a step up. And that's exactly the opposite of what was going on 30 years ago.
Now, American businesses are going to say all of that shared prosperity might sound great, but it was killing us. And by the 1970s, it was starting to hurt, and we needed to do something. Lewis Powell generates a theory that that businesses need to get together because they're under assault. There's a threat to the American business community.
That is actually interesting. Lewis Powell was and this was a brand new story to me. Frank, I have to make a confession to you and your listeners. I ran the New York Times Washington Bureau in the late 70s, and I saw the impact of the Powell memo, and we're going to get into it. I knew nothing about it. And about 3 weeks ago, we had a book party at Mark Shields, the columnist for the Washington Post, and guys like Bob Schieffer and Jim Lehrer and others were there. And I told the Powell story that I'm about to tell your listeners. Only one other reporter out of about 50 in the room besides me knew anything about this. Lewis Powell was a guy, a corporate attorney from Richmond, Virginia, so prominent that he was elected president of the American Bar Association. He was appointed by Nixon to the Supreme Court at the end of 1971. But 2 months earlier, he had become so alarmed at what he saw as the threat, the mortal threat. He used that term, mortal threat, to the American free enterprise system from Ralph Nader and the consumer movement, from the labor movement, from the government, the regulatory regime of the Environment Protection Agency and other agencies, and most of them established by his friend Richard Nixon, who was a big buddy of American CEOs, but believed that government had to regulate the excesses of American industry and American capitalism to make it work for the long run. Maybe not so much short-term profit, but better for the long run, better for society. Powell thought this was a disaster, he said to business leaders, and he circulated this memo through the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Get organized, get political, get aggressive, identify your enemies, go out, punish them, run them out of town, take over the high ground, take power back in Washington. When Powell wrote that memo, there were only 175 companies that actually had offices in Washington. Think of it. So there were not many people there who even were in the political game. After the Powell memo, 8 years after the Powell memo, there were 2,425. Huge increase. The Business Roundtable, which is now the single most powerful voice of the major corporations in America, the 150, 160 largest corporations in America, all Fortune 500 types, that kind, it didn't exist. 4 months after Powell's memo was circulated, the leaders of GE, the leaders of GM, of DuPont, and I talked to them, Irving Shapiro at DuPont, Reg Jones at GE, they organized the Business Roundtable. Enormous clout. And then they came to Washington to fight for the legislation they wanted. The National Federation of Independent Businesses, which had about 4,000 members, small business, a decade later had 600,000. There were 50,000 people by 1980 representing business trade associations. So the Powell memo lit a spark. Now, Powell didn't do it all by himself. This was a business movement. There were a lot of other business leaders who were clearly unhappy with the way American politics were going. And Powell simply was the Paul Revere, the call to arms. But they responded. And when I was sitting there in the Washington Bureau, I don't know, you weren't sitting too far away, as I recall. We saw tremendous things happening. I mean,
and what was it they want? They want less regulation, lower taxes.
Yeah. Well, less regulation they got easily. What's interesting is everybody thinks they got it when Ronald Reagan, Republican president, comes in 1980-81 and the Republicans take over the Senate. What I found out when I went back and did my history, the pivotal Congress in American history over the last 50 years was the Congress of 1978. Interesting. Democrats were in control of both houses of Congress. And Jimmy Carter was the president sitting in the White House. So the first thing business wanted to do was to block the labor unions and block Ralph Nader. Nader wanted a consumer protection agency. Labor wanted bills that would help it organize more people, particularly in the South. Those bills got strangled in the crypt. They never got out of Congress. The business, what I call Powell's army, organized and it stopped them. But then they wanted something else. So Eastman Kodak and Xerox, they wanted the 401k for their executives. By the way, the 401k was never intended to be a national retirement plan. This was strictly a favor to those two companies. It got put in the tax code. They got a change in the corporate bankruptcy law, which sounds like wonkish policy stuff for a bunch of think tanks. It had enormous impact. What it did was it left the old management in a company in control of the company instead of putting in a bankruptcy referee or umpire, somebody who was neutral. So when you got all those bankruptcies of the steel companies and the airlines rolling through those industries and other industries in the 1990s and 2000s, the old management simply went to court and crunched labor. And in the United Airlines bankruptcy, which I use as a case study, the employees gave up $4 billion. Pilots and mechanics and stewardesses and so forth. Yeah, they gave up wages. They gave up health benefits. They gave up retirement benefits. Huge, terribly costly.
Because the law took away a referee.
Because the law took away the referee. And not that they wouldn't have lost under the old system, but it would have been the pain would have been parceled out differently. You know. And then you get the first time Wall Street and the banks say, hey, take the lid off interest rates. We don't need any. States like North Carolina, probably Michigan, certainly Illinois, Wisconsin, California, and New York, they had usury laws that said there's a limit to what interest rate you can charge on an auto loan, on a home mortgage, on a student loan. So they got a law passed that eliminated that, set up this whole subprime thing. Interest rates could go up to 20, 22, 23%. By the way, this was supposed to protect the banks against poor creditors. But guess what the interest rate is if you don't pay your credit card on time for you? And you're a good solid customer? You're paying that 20 or 22%. The banks are raking in that money. Back before the 1978 Congress, they couldn't have done that. And then, as you point out, they rolled back the tax law. The capital gains rate was cut dramatically. The corporate gains tax rate was cut, not dramatically, but it was cut. It went in the exact opposite direction from previous history. That period, that 1978 Congress, which was the result of the Powell Army, the result of the Powell memo, was a game changer. It changed the psychology. It changed the landscape of power in Washington, and we're living with it today. It's been the same way ever since.
Talking to Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His latest book is called Who Stole the American Dream? More on that after a short break. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Last night, Mitt Romney, President Barack Obama, debated for the last time before Election Day the emphasis on foreign policy, although the economy and the suffering of the American middle class did work its way into the conversation. My guest today documents that suffering in his new book, Who Stole the American Dream? Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, covered the American South, the Vietnam War, the former Soviet Union, Cold War, all of that for the New York Times. And now, as I say, his latest book, Who Stole the American Dream? So before this, we're talking about the power of the rising middle class. It is enjoying the same prosperity and productivity gains as businesses. But look, this was, and you talked about the turning point, 1978, but it's also a time of stagflation. We have double-digit interest rates, double-digit inflation. Businesses are hurting, and part of it, they say, is this leverage. They're having to fight too many rules, too high taxes. There's a globalized economy now, so market forces are changing. Unions are too strong. Didn't they have a point somewhere?
Yeah, there's no question that globalization and the movement of industry, the challenge, actually, of industry, first from Korea, Hong Kong, and Taiwan, then later from mainland China and now India and so forth, it's changed the playing field, the global playing field that American corporations have had to play on. And then you've got advancing technology, internet, computer technology, software, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, old-fashioned industries were under assault, and there was definitely going to be some change. But, you know, to a certain extent, that's a misleading half-truth. I mean, it's only half of the truth. What happens is, how do you respond to that? And American business leaders changed. They used to say our job was to make sure all the parties, all the stakeholders get a share of the benefits, a share of the gains. So if things get tough, then everybody shares the pain. Then when things start to get better again, and we did pull out of stagflation eventually. I mean, Reagan came into power. We had some growth then, and it fell off. But particularly when Clinton came in the late 90s, a period of tremendous growth and a period of real booming stock market and so forth, that was the time when business could have shared a lot more than it did. But businesses said, no, we can't compete internationally. We can't make it. Well, I'm sorry. I used to buy that argument, Frank. But then somebody suggested, why don't you look overseas and see whether or not you see the same results overseas as you see in America? If you look at the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the 34 most advanced economies in the world, the disparity of income in America is the most extreme of all those except for Chile and Mexico. So if you're worried about America becoming a banana republic, don't worry about it anymore. We're already there. We're worse than Brazil. We're worse than Argentina. There are only two more Latin Americans that are worse than we are. But more importantly, if you look at a country like Germany, where the leaders in both politics and business took a different strategy, they actually helped the middle class in Germany while they were trying to compete. They faced the same Chinese competition then and now as we do. They faced the same push from India, particularly in the software and the computer field as we do, the Asian tigers and so forth. German wages for the middle class have improved five times faster in the last 25 years than in America. Now, we were told Caterpillar, you name it, big companies said they couldn't possibly raise wages. So Caterpillar just imposed a wage freeze on its workers while it had $4.9 billion profits last year, record profits. But the Germans were increasing their wages. Well, then you might say, well, maybe, I mean, Daimler-Benz, Mercedes, BMW, Airbus, Siemens, those big companies, you'd think they would have suffered. They didn't. They've done very well competitively. What about the whole German economy? If you look at our trade figures from 2000 to 2010, we had a $6 trillion trade deficit. We bought $6 trillion more from the world than we sold. Very bad for American business, very bad for American workers, very bad for the whole economy. Germany, at the same time, had a $2 trillion trade deficit surplus. Excuse me. They sold $2 trillion more. BMWs and Mercedes and so forth were selling in terms of profit. We're doing much better in China, for example, than American car makers were. So,
well, how did they do it? Why did they resist the market pressure to manufacture overseas and get rid of those jobs?
Well, what they did basically is they worked together. Management and labor sat down together. The labor unions were strong there. Management and labor said, how do we save the best high-tech jobs in Germany? How do we save the best high-wage jobs? Yes, we're going to offshore some jobs, but if we offshore them, let's offshore the low end. And let's do all we can to keep manufacturing. And this is really interesting because manufacturing is the heart of a good middle-class economy. Those are the best-paying blue-collar jobs, and not only for blue-collar. But if those car industries and manufacturing industries are working well, then they employ a lot of and hire a lot of engineers, designers, salespeople, advertising people, grocery stores, automobile dealers, real estate agents. Everybody benefits. Those jobs have big multiplier. Germany hung on to 21% of its workforce in manufacturing, and we have 9% today in ours. So while our companies were busy offshoring not only low-end jobs, but high-end jobs as well, and plenty of them, by the way, in the knowledge economy. I got chapters on blue-collar jobs and on knowledge economy jobs. There's no safety in the knowledge economy. The number of software jobs and IT jobs that are going overseas and back-office jobs in American banks and American companies is huge, and people haven't faced up to that. The Germans took a different path. They took a different strategy. And it's interesting. Talk to Klaus Kleinfeld, who is the head of Alcoa now and was the head of the German firm Siemens. You can tell by his names. He is a German. And ask him what the secret is. And what he says is the social contract. It is the decision of business leaders and government leaders to form a partnership to develop the national economy and its partnerships between business and labor and also nonprofits. So they had a very different philosophy. It wasn't combative. It wasn't us against them. It wasn't divisive the way our politics are. It wasn't divisive the way our economics are. And Germany has come out much better. The German middle class is better off than the American middle class today. And the German economy is better off. I'm talking about over the last 25, 30 years. Right. I'm not just talking about the last year and a half or so.
So how does that contract get broken in the United States? In other words, what are the political forces that decoupled, let's say, the Democratic Party from those working ideals, those middle-class ideals? Somehow working-class voters didn't find their kinship anymore with the Democratic Party. What happened?
Yeah, you got two things going on. The first thing that goes on is in the economy. First thing that happens is business leaders say, we're going to take more for ourselves. So CEO pay shoots up. They get stock options. You get Larry Ellison at Oracle taking $700 million in 1 year. You get Mike Eisner at Disney getting $400 million in a year. You get Sandy Weill at Citigroup having 3 years, roughly $200 million a year. So they're taking a huge chunk of the profits from the company, and they're not paying it to people. So the basic problem is in the economy. But what's also going on politically is a decoupling of this old idea of shared wealth when the economy prospers. The tax rate for the top people is coming down from 92% under Eisenhower to 35% under George W. Bush. And at the same time, the payroll tax, which is the tax that everybody has to pay for Social Security and Medicare, is doubling from 3.5% to 7.65%. The minimum wage is rising much more slowly than average wages. The estate taxes are coming down much faster. So the benefits to people at the top are growing, and the burdens on people in the middle and the bottom are growing. But the biggest burden shift of all, well, there are two really big burden shifts that matter. One is the 401k plan comes in, and hundreds of billions of dollars of expenditures on retirement are shifted from the cost of companies to the cost of individuals. That's huge. Every year, the middle class is paying that much more. And the second big thing is what I call the upside-down mortgage. During the housing boom, before it broke and hit bottom, homeowners, mostly middle-class homeowners, lost, listen to this number, $6 trillion. They were encouraged by the banks to refinance and to keep sucking money out of their home equity. In the late 1980s, homeowners owned 70% of the value of their own homes. They'd paid in their mortgage payments. By 2009, they only owned 40% of their own homes. Not just did the prices of homes come down, but the share came down. That's 30% of the home ownership in America shifted from homeowners to banks. All that money moved from middle-class people to banks and to wealthy Wall Street investors. That is probably the biggest single shift of wealth in America's history, and it wasn't just not trickled down. It was like the Mississippi River flowing backwards, going upwards, this massive amount of money moving upwards to the rich away from the middle class. And the policies that the government was pushing, Alan Greenspan at the Fed, what Congress was passing, all of this was helping. They were passing laws that made all of this much easier, made it happen.
So you have a rapid shift in the economy that's hurting a lot of people all at once. They should feel it, and they should probably be agitating for change. They don't seem to be doing that. What? Why not? And what can be done?
Well, that's a jackpot question. I mean, because if we'd been back in the 60s and 70s, people would have been marching in the streets. If we'd had millions of foreclosures of homes and by robo-signers when the banks didn't even have the right to
it's illegal.
They were illegal. Yeah. In fact, it was so illegal that the banks even agreed to pay a $25 billion fine. Okay, so even the banks knew they were illegal when they got pushed. They got exposed by the press and the regulators. But back in that earlier period, something would have been done. There would have been a tent city on the mall. There would have been people rallying around bank offices saying, don't push these people out of their houses and so forth. All kinds of things would have been going on. I think a lot has happened in American psychology. If you think back to the civil rights period and Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream, and we're talking about the American dream period, the dream, his dream was having equal rights and so forth. There was an enormous idealism in America. People don't protest that way if they don't think things are going to get better or they don't think they can make things get better. I have a friend named Ernie Cortez, who's one of the great field organizers in the Southwest. He's a Latino in Texas, and he works in Southern California, Mexico, New Mexico, and Arizona. He says, paraphrasing that old saying, power corrupts, powerlessness also corrupts. In other words, if people feel they can't have any impact, if they've lost faith in the ability of democracy to change things, people complain in the polls. They say, rightly, Congress doesn't pay any attention to us. Lobbyists have way too much power. 80% of the people say lobbyists should be stripped of power. Lobbyists shouldn't be allowed to contribute to political campaigns. But along with that, doesn't come, we need to do something about it. Remember I said before, the middle-class prosperity of the 60s and 70s depended on middle-class power, the exercise of middle-class power. Middle class is not exercising power today. People don't believe they can do it. And I don't think things are going to change much until people actually decide, I got to get up off the couch. Remember, people will say to me, look, crazy idea, Rick. My colleagues in the media in Washington say, you're a nut. Nobody's ever going to do that. People don't feel that way anymore. It used to work in the 70s. It can't work today. And my response to that is twofold. Number one, as long as we out here in North Carolina, or I could be in Texas, or I could be in Connecticut, or I could be in Colorado, as long as we say they've got to change the system back there in Washington, it's not going to happen. They're quite happy with the system the way it is. Members of Congress like it this way. The lobbyists like it this way. The big business, the big mules of business, they like it this way. So we're going to have to change it ourselves. We're going to have to demonstrate and protest. And when people say to me, how can we do that? It's too hard. Look at what happened. Occupy sort of fizzled out. Occupy wasn't a movement the same way those other movements were. They didn't have clear leaders. They didn't have clear goals. They couldn't draw support from other people. Maybe people can't go out and demonstrate. Maybe it's the younger people who demonstrate more. But other people can give them support, moral support. They can show up for a big march like the March on Washington, maybe once a year. They can give financial support. They can give moral support. They can go to meetings with members of Congress. There are all kinds of things that people can do. Think about it, how hard it was for the civil rights movement. Well, say, well, it's too hard now. Organized money, super PACs, they've got us beaten. Imagine if you were Rosa Parks and you grew up in rural Alabama in the 1940s, in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and you moved to Montgomery and you're in Montgomery and you were angry at having to sit at the back of the bus. But this was segregation. This is the way things were done. It had been that way for a century or more. The big mules in Birmingham and Montgomery were in charge. The cops would arrest you in a moment. You couldn't get bail money. Everything was against you. But one day, Rosa Parks said, sat down in the front of the bus and said, I'm not going to the back of the bus. I'm tired of it. It's unfair. They had a vision of a better democracy, a vision of more equal rights. And they had very practical goals. We don't want to sit in the back of the bus. We want to drink at the drinking fountains. I covered John Lewis and those guys in Nashville, Tennessee. They want to eat at the lunch counters. They want to ride in the Freedom Rider buses. They want to stay in the hotels. They wanted blacks to have the same shot at decent jobs. You know, where? In the department stores, in the automobile dealerships, and just ordinary things in American life. And they insisted on it. Well, I guess my answer here is, improbable as it sounds, there got to be a whole bunch of middle-class Americans who say, hey, this is intolerable. We're not moving to the back of the bus anymore. We're not taking this flat pay. We're not taking people being ousted. We're not taking the bailout. Gee, many Christmas, the banks got bailed out to the tune of $700 billion. And the banks didn't turn around and bail out the homeowners. Well, what about bailing out the homeowners? By the way, if we did it, and they're paying now 8 or 9% loans they got in this bad bubble era, those bad bubble era mortgages. If they refinance today at 3.5% or 4%, you'd have families with $1,000 a month that they could spend. Yeah, multiply that by the millions, and you're talking hundreds of billions of dollars of consumer purchasing power every year. That's the engine. That's the job-creating engine in the American economy that we could cut loose. We're not doing it.
Edric Smith, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Frank, a real pleasure to be with you.
Edric Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His new book is called Who Stole the American Dream? And he reads tonight, 7 o'clock, Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.